We're now the fourth largest tobacco company in Japan.
Well, Louis, look, I'm really happy that you're here to meet me this morning.
Thank you.
You know, I've known you for a long time. I've had your children in my program.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Right?
My son probably started at three. He's 32 now.
That's right.
So that's 29 32. Years ago.
Because my third son is 33.
Okay.
Right, because Louis is 35, so my third son is 33, and the one I have one is 31.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, same age.
What is he doing now?
So he's a graphic designer. He's had several jobs, I mean, proper jobs. And during COVID, he got laid off, and he just decided to go freelance, and he's been doing it ever since.
But where is he? Is he in New York?
Oh, he's in New York. Okay. Both my kids are in New York.
Okay.
My daughter's in Brooklyn. He's in Manhattan.
But she's younger than him, right?
Yeah, she's 2 years younger.
Okay, so what is she doing?
She works for a hotel. She works for a large Brooklyn hotel. She's the events planner.
Okay.
So she's having a great time.
All right.
That's what she does, plans events for this hotel. And she just loves it.
Have you been to the hotel? I'm sure several times. Stay there.
It's a hotel called the William. No, I haven't stayed.
I'm planning to. Okay.
But it's a hotel called the William and Vale Hotel. It's
I'm
a small boutique hotel. I mean, small meaning it's small compared to some of these larger chains, but it's a nice hotel.
Okay.
It's a very nice hotel.
I think about
250 rooms.
Right. Let's start. Where were you born, Louis? Because I don't know that.
Okay, I was born in Tokyo, and I grew up in Yokohama. So I spent my formative years in Japan, basically.
And so how old were you when you left Japan? So I don't know how far to talk.
I left Japan
when you were
after my sophomore year of high school.
Okay.
And I went to private school in the States, in Connecticut.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So when you were growing up, tell me, so you started, you said you grew up, did you go through Japanese school or international school?
No, international school. So in those days, my first school was Yokohama International School.
Okay.
And then for business reasons, when I was probably 5 and 6 years old, for 2 years, my father went to the Philippines. So the whole family moved, relocated to the Philippines.
Did you learn Tagalog?
I probably did. Spoke a little bit when I was a kid, but we were there for about 2 years.
How many siblings do you have?
I have an older sister and a younger brother.
Okay, how many years difference between you guys?
2 years with my sister, 1.5 years with my brother.
Oh, so you guys are close.
Yeah, we're pretty close.
Well,
yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, so you went to the Philippines.
And I came back here probably at the age of 6 and went to YIS, Yokohama International School. In those days, and only went to 8th grade. It only went to 8th grade.
Right?
Yeah, so you had to graduate at 8th grade. And at that point, you basically had to choose between St. Mary's or ASIJ.
You had St. Joseph's, too.
Oh, yes, which would have been really, okay, that wasn't even off with my parents. They said, no, you're not going there.
No, they knew that. No, Jesuit priests are going to be teaching you.
You're not going there. So that wasn't even an option for us, I guess. But so I ended up going to St. Mary's. I was there for a couple of years, and then I went to boarding school in the States after my sophomore year.
Where'd you go to boarding school?
A place called The Gunnery. In Washington, Connecticut. It sounds like a military academy, but it's not. It was a school that was founded by a guy by the name of, I think he was Alfred Gunn, G-U-N-N, and he named his school The Gunnery.
Wait, so did your brother go?
No, he went to a different boarding school. He went to boarding school as
and
well.
And did your sister?
She went to finishing school in Switzerland, actually.
Wait, what kind of child were you? First of all, were you more academic or were you more sports-minded? As a child?
Probably more sports. Definitely not academic. No, I was into tennis. I did a lot of squash when I was, So my probably the last 4 years of high school and then all the way through until I got to about 45, I was playing a lot of squash.
Is that right?
Yeah, that was my thing.
Well, did your father play squash?
No. My father and I played tennis.
Okay, yeah. So he got you into tennis.
He got me into tennis. Right. We played a lot together, actually. He played tennis until he was about 84 years old.
Now, your father's American.
Yep.
Okay. And your mother's Japanese?
Yes.
All right.
Naturalized American.
Are they with us still?
No. Well, my father died about 12 years ago.
Okay.
My mother's still with us.
He lived for quite... How old was he when he
passed? He just reached 90. He was 90 in 1 month. 90 in 1 month when he passed away.
Was he doing pretty good?
He was good. He had all his faculties. He was in the hospital for whatever reason, and I went to visit. This was in May, of 2008, I guess. And I went to visit him, and there was a lady that was taking care of him. They were long divorced.
How old were you when they divorced?
That's another story, man. They were in court for a long time. So officially, I guess, I was already an adult.
Okay, when that happened. So they stayed together while you were young?
Yes. Okay. Yes. But anyway, so he was in the hospital when he was, this last time that he actually had some complications. The lady who was taking care of him said, "Lewis, I think you better come over to visit, right?"
So where was he staying? Where was he?
This was in
But where
in
was
Manila.
He living?
He was in Manila.
Oh, he stayed there?
That's okay. So
you wouldn't get it. Come on, okay, let's get
so,
into it.
I'm sorry. So we were there for 2 years when I was 5 and 6. Right. And then the business that he was working on ended, and we all came back to Japan. And when he retired from his business, he had a company, back in probably 1986. That's when he decided, I don't want to go back to the States. I really liked my life in the Philippines during the 2 years that we were actually living there when I was a kid, and he decided to move to the Philippines, and he retired in the Philippines. So he spent the last 25 years of his life in the Philippines.
Yeah. So he spoke Tagalog, I bet you.
Not at all. He didn't speak Japanese either. And he was in Japan for probably 40 years. he could tell the driver left, right, and straight. But
what did your dad do? What did he do?
So he was a businessman. He import distribution. I took over his business.
Okay.
But that's another story. He had just lost 98% of the business.
Right.
Which was one brand, one product.
It was a very lucrative business.
It was lucrative until they decided, okay, thank you, you did a great job, we don't need you anymore. And they took over the market that he had developed for Kent Cigarettes. That was Kent Cigarettes. And the remaining 2% was the business that I actually took over.
Which was
a small cigar business.
Okay. Yeah.
Small mass market cigars. We did American King Edward and Habitant cigars.
Was your father a smoker?
Yes. He smoked until he was probably 65 or 66, and he got emphysema and just cold turkey from one day to the next.
And then he lived another...
He lived another 25 years.
Yeah.
He played tennis until he was 84 years old. Oh, he was an active tennis. He played, I would say, 3 or 4 times a week.
Is that right?
In the heat of Manila.
What about now? Did you stop playing tennis, or do you still play tennis?
I don't play tennis anymore.
I'm a golfer.
I'm a golfer. I stopped playing squash when I was 25. It's not good for your back. It's a lot of this bending, torsion stuff, and I would get a slip disc probably twice a year, and basically when you get something like that, it incapacitates you for a week. I mean, literally, I was lying. You couldn't lie on a bed because it's too soft. You have to lie on the floor, and I could not get up for 2 or 3 days, and then spend another 3 or 4 days just taking it easy. And that would happen twice a year.
Because of you played regularly, though.
I would play probably 3 or 4 times a week.
Wow.
Yeah, I was very active.
So my curiosity comes in when you were in school here. What made them decide to put you all in boarding schools? Was that something that you desired, you wanted, or what?
I don't know. I don't think so. I had a lot of friends here.
Most people don't want to leave their friends, right?
Yeah, exactly. We were in our formative years. We were in our years where you're really curious about
a
lot of things.
Did your father go to boarding school?
No.
Did your mother?
No. But we all went. My sister went to a place in Lausanne called Chateaubriand for the last 2 years of her high school. I went to the gunnery, and my brother went to Northfield Mount Hermon in Massachusetts.
None of you went to the same?
No, we didn't go to the same school. Yeah.
Was that by choice or just because your parents picked everything?
They picked everything.
Well, who'd you stay with? You were in boarding school. Stayed with no one.
You came home.
You're
in a dorm.
Right.
You're in a dorm.
So what was that like?
It was something getting used to. We were in Japan, and you know, we had the YCAC, or in those days we used to go to the Yokohama Yacht Club, which was a great place to hang out. And I'm there almost every weekend with my friends, and all of a sudden they pick us up and place us in a
you had
a
no,
very
you didn't know.
Oh no! Of course we knew.
You knew.
So
it was
we, because I'm the one
to
had
go
to.
Against it.
We had. Well, I'm not sure if we really went against it, but I did have to work on the application. You know, fill out the reasons I want to go and that kind of stuff. But yeah, that was a. It was a. Look, I ended up getting used to it, and I actually ended up liking it. Okay, but it's it was the first, I would say, maybe 6 months. You're getting used to a totally different environment. You have new friends. You have and friends that didn't have the freedoms that we had growing up over here. I mean, growing up over here was the Wild East. It was the wild, wild East, man. I mean, you basically, you roam the prairies, as you say. You know, it's we had control of everything.
Right.
And especially if you could speak Japanese.
That's right.
I mean,
you had access to
basically get
you
away with just about anything.
That's right.
Especially in those days. I'm not sure if. I want a kid growing up today wanting to hear what I'm saying now.
But
in those days, this is 40 years ago, 50 years ago, we really just had a great time in childhood.
So when you went there, everything became really restricted and closed in and
near
as far as you could do.
A lot of rules. A lot of you can't do this and you can't do that. No.
So you had how many years of that?
No, 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah, 2 years of that, and then I ended up going to Boston University. For 1 year, and I decided I wanted to come back here. So from my sophomore year, I came back here. I went to Sophia from sophomore year.
You're my son's senpai.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, two of them.
I'm a lot of people's senpai these days.
They also went to Yokohama as well.
Yokohama International School.
Yes, two of my kids went to Yokohama, two went to
the
same one.
Have you been to the new campus?
No, I haven't been there. Okay, so when you finished school, what did you study while you were in college?
When I came back here, I studied economics and Far Eastern Studies. I had a double major in Far Eastern Studies.
All right, so how did you use it when you came out? I know you took over a portion of your father's business that was left.
That was tough because it was, we had just lost. You know, I went to business school afterwards.
At Sophia?
No. I graduated Sophia 1976, I guess it was. And then I came back here. I was here. I worked for about 4 years. And from 1980 to 1982, I went to business school, London Business School. I was in London.
What made you decide to go there?
I didn't want to go to the States. First of all, the schools were all big. I mean, large business schools like Harvard or Columbia. You know, their graduating class is like 700 people or something, right? It's a lot. The school I chose was 100 people, right?
Okay.
And so a lot smaller. It's a two-year program, so you really get to know these guys really well, and you go out drinking with them. I mean, we really had a nice group, and I'm still
in
contact
with them.
I'm used to here. Yeah, so I'm still in contact with quite a few of them. It's nice. We have a reunion probably like every 5 years, and I went to the last one was just before COVID. It was around 19. That was our 35th. That was 2017 that I went. Yeah.
Okay. So when you finished that, then you started working for your father.
No, when I came back, my father decided. Okay, he had just lost 98% of the business. I was in business school. He came to see me. He didn't want me to go to, I don't know, work at McKinsey or Goldman Sachs or any place. He says, I want you to come over and come back to Japan and take over the business. He didn't tell me. He had just lost 98% of the business. So I'm saying, all right, my guy, my buddies are going to be slaving working for Goldman Sachs, right? And I'm going to be the CEO of a company, a great company, right? He didn't tell me he had just lost 98% of the business. So I come back to Japan, I walk into the office and everybody's solemn faced, right? And I said, what's wrong? And they say, well, you didn't hear? I said, what? We don't have a business.
He didn't say anything.
And that's when he decided to pack up his bags
he'd already signed the papers and taken it all over.
Well, yeah. So it was tough, obviously. And the remaining 2% was a small cigar business, a mass market cigar business. And I said, okay, so the only thing that we can do, really, is to develop the only know-how that we have, which is tobacco. So we had to develop the tobacco business. But at the same time, I said, well, we have to make sure that we don't put all our eggs in one basket again, right? So at the same time, I said, okay, I'm going to develop a lot of other different businesses not related to tobacco.
How many different businesses?
I would say over the 40 years that I've been doing this, probably, if you count all the companies, probably more than 30.
Okay.
If you count the, let's say, businesses or the industries, markets, it's probably about 15.
Wow.
Yeah. But we did a lot. And some of them stuck and some of them didn't really pan out, so we would stop
after
a couple
partners?
Years.
Did you have partners? You're saying we did a lot, so was it
well,
you?
Well, I include everybody that worked for me.
Okay,
I own the company.
Okay, so you always, it was never you and some other partners.
I never had shareholders or partners. No.
Okay.
No. So I was always the CEO, the boss, but we did a lot. We accomplished a lot.
What were some of your biggest challenges then when you came in there? I know one thing is to get more than 2% you just said.
Well, we created a business. We're now the fourth largest tobacco company in Japan. Yeah. After JT, Philip Morris, and BAT, and then it's us, right? And we've been, JT's biggest growth combustible, okay, which is a product called Natural American Spirit, is a company that I developed the market for in Japan. You've heard of Natural American Spirit?
Yeah. All
right, so they bought the international rights from R.J. Reynolds, who bought it from a bunch of hippies that I was representing in Santa Fe. The hippies sold it to R.J. Reynolds for about $350 million,
okay.
Right? Reynolds took it, and you know, so I became the agents for R.J. Reynolds for about 2 or 3 years, until they decided they're going to do it on their own. So they patted me on the back the same way they patted my father on the back,
right,
and took away Kent cigarettes. So Reynolds took it over from me. They developed a market for it, and then JT basically said, okay, well, why don't we just buy the whole thing from Reynolds, right? So they bought ex-USA. They bought the global rights for it for about $3.2 billion. So they, whatever, you know, Reynolds at that time, you know, paid $350 million to a bunch of hippies, okay, and they turned around and sell it for 3.2 and kept the United States, which was their biggest market.
Wow.
So this is a great deal for Reynolds.
Okay, so.
So JT ended up with Natural American Spirit, which is a brand that I developed originally. And then after we lost Natural American Spirit, I developed the brand. The manufacturer was Imperial Tobacco, probably the fourth or fifth largest tobacco company in the world. And we had a product called West. And again, that when my father lost Kent Cigarettes, his business was about, I'd say about 300 million sticks, right?
Okay.
And that's when manufacturers decide, okay, well, it's big enough now where we could take over the business.
No, say it again?
Yeah.
It was
350 million sticks. The whole market at the time was 350 billion. So it was.
No, when you say sticks, you mean that's cigarette.
One piece. So it's 20 sticks to a pack.
Okay.
Right? 300 million sticks.
And when you get to that amount,
yeah,
you're talking about that's how many are sold, what, yearly?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
When you sold that much a year, that's when tobacco.
That's when the companies say, okay, well, the market is big enough where we could basically take over and we don't need an agent anymore. We'll just create a subsidiary. So when he lost Kent Cigarettes, it was around 300 million sticks. When I lost Natural American Spirit, it was also around 320 million sticks.
What did you take it at? How many sticks did they have when
zero.
When you took it?
Oh, zero. I developed. I created the market for it. The
and
brand
that's
was
what
there.
Your father did the same thing when he came here.
That was 40 years ago.
Right, I understand. But he came here, it was zero. So you started zero,
that's
then
right.
You came up to three. When you get up 300 million.
Yeah. So 300 really is a threshold.
Okay.
Is a threshold. we've experienced that three times. Okay. Kent with my father, Natural American Spirit with me. And then we did it a third time with a product called West, which was ITG, Imperial Tobacco Group. And we reached about 350. A million sticks, and that's when they said, "Okay, thank you. You did a great
job."
And
they pay you off. Right.
They give you compensation. It really it helps 1 year because it pays the overheads for that 1 year. But don't forget, when you get paid that compensation, you still have to pay the corporate tax on the compensation. So you know, 34% goes.
That's right. It's 34%.
In those days, it could have been 38%.
Okay.
Yeah, it's 34% now. Corporate income tax.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And then after that, what we did was we created, this was probably the most genius thing that we did as a company. because we knew the arbitrage between, let's say, the taxation on cigarettes and the taxation on what we call OTP, other tobacco products, which would include cigars, pipe tobaccos, roll your own, and that kind of stuff, snus stuff, that kind of stuff, right?
So you're dealing in that as well, did you?
Yes, we do. So we're the largest OTP company in Japan, right? So we knew the arbitrage. Okay. We're the largest OTP company, but OTP business is very, very small. But we're the largest of the small.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
But we're also the only OTP company that was ever successful in a mass market cigarette. So we knew the dynamic. Okay. So the way cigarette is taxed, it's taxed on volume. Okay. So 1,000 sticks, one piece is one stick. Okay. 1,000 sticks, a certain taxation. Okay. Cigars is OTP is taxed on net weight. So 1,000 grams is the same taxation as 1,000 sticks.
Okay.
So when the cigar and a cigarette is, when a cigar is 1 gram, it's the same taxation as cigarettes. That's where you have parity. Okay. We created a product that has 0.4 grams. So there was a tiny little cigar that basically was light enough to smoke as a cigarette, and we're not paying 60%. Of what goes into a pack of cigarettes, which is taxation. 60% of 60% is what we save on taxes because it was 0.4 and it's priced as a cigar, which is on net weight. So we developed a product, this was in 2016 we developed this, and our sales just went through the roof because it's cheap, because you're not paying 60% of the taxation on cigarettes. So we could sell it for, you know, 30-40% lower than a pack of cigarettes, and basically it smokes like a cigarette.
Would you still put 20 in a pack?
We still put 20 in a pack, but let's say a pack of cigarettes in those days, 2016, was, let's say, 450 yen. Our product was 290 yen. So I told you, Kent was 300. Natural American Spirit was probably 320 or 350. ITG West was about 350 million sticks. This thing, because we did it with a product called Forte, F-O-R-T-E, and another one called Blackjack, the two together, we did 1.9 billion. And it got to a point where it was
yearly.
1.9 billion yearly. In sticks.
I understand.
Yeah, in sticks. It's not necessarily.
I understand, okay. Yeah. Go on.
So it became, and we basically said, okay, well, we got to keep this thing under the radar. 1.9 billion is substantial, but it's still less than 2% market share, equivalent of cigarettes, right? And we were basically very, very cautious that the Ministry of Finance, which regulates the tobacco industry, because that's who collects taxes, we want to keep it under their radar. So we made sure that we kept it under 2%. But because of our success, obviously, JT was looking at us, Philip Morris was looking at us, BAT was looking at us, all our smaller competitors were looking at us, and they said, we gotta do the same thing. Everybody copied me, and this arbitrage that I discovered, okay, reached about 13% market share of the cigarette business. It's not a cigarette, but equivalent. It's 13% market share.
How long did you have it to yourself? 2 years?
Probably three and a half years.
Three and a half years.
They changed the law because of what I did.
To what?
To basically anything under 1 gram is now considered 1 gram. So they took away the arbitrage completely because of what I did.
What you did. But yeah. You had 3 good years of it.
We had three and a half good years with that, yeah. And so we lost the arbitrage. We lost a lot of sales, obviously.
Of course.
But our business combined, Forte and Blackjack, is still about, I would say, about 600 million sticks. Yeah, so we lost about 60% of our volume. But we still have 300.
So JT's competing with you right now?
Well, they all still have their products, but I think eventually they're gonna. Give it up because they lost the arbitrage, so it's not as lucrative anymore. So, you know, why bother? And they were basically, I think they did it deliberately to just shut me down. They said, okay, we can't let this guy run with it. Let's do our own. We'll get two good quarters out of it before the Japanese government steps in and changes the law.
They knew it would happen right away.
They knew it would, but they needed to stop me. I mean, that's I guess that's par good. For the course. That's just part of, you know, a free comp, free market society.
That's right. Well, this isn't that free, but still.
You got that right. Yeah, you got that right. So that's where we are today. And okay.
How long ago was that?
We started 2016. We had it probably all to ourselves until about end of 2019 or something. And then they changed the law 2020, effective 2021-22. That's when we lost. And they did it in two phases. We were taxed at 0.4 when we had it all to ourselves. 2021, I think we got to 0.7. And then 2022, it went to one, basic one for one. Yeah. Even though it's like 0.4 grams, so it's a tiny little thing, it's taxed like a cigarette.
My goodness. Yeah. So where do we find you today?
I'm getting ready to retire, so I'm.
Is your son thinking about it?
Oh no. When I left for the States in 2003, and left with the whole family, thinking that they could get a better education, someplace in the United States, in private school in the States, and my kids actually never came back to Japan. I mean, not to live. They love visiting. Last year they visited twice and spent at least 2 or 3 weeks each time. But they don't have the same, you know, bilingual, bicultural advantage that I had, because I kind of grew up over here and I stayed here and I spent my formative years and then my early business years I spent here, right? But they didn't have that advantage, and that's something that I regret, because I kind of took that away from them. I think we probably would have been better off spending summers here. They would have, you know, developed a network of Japanese friends and had a better command of the language and that kind of stuff. But I made them New Yorkers.
So, do you want to stay? Where do you plan on retiring? Are you going to be staying here, or you're going to be doing, like a lot of people are going, 6 months one place, 6 months another place, or either 4 months, 4 months, 4 months, something like that. So what are you thinking?
That's exactly what I'm doing. I'm doing that now.
Okay.
Because I'm in New York.
And your wife comes with you too?
My wife is here now.
Does she like Japan?
My wife is Japanese.
I know. I know a lot of Japanese that don't like Japan.
I don't really know anybody that doesn't like Japan.
But you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but
I know. Okay, so she's comfortable living in the States. She loves the States. But yeah, so she's here now, and she's spending a lot more time here. First of all, her mother is getting on in age, right? And she's very, very close to her mother. So she's taking care of her mother. Mm. So she's spending a lot more time here. She's here now. I'm leaving the end of this month, but she'll stay on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm not quite sure exactly when she's going to go back to the States. But yeah. But we've been doing this really for 20 years now, just this back and forth. You know, mm-hmm. I visit. You know, when I first moved to New York, I was going back and forth probably 7, 8, 9 times a year. Right. I think you know that.
Every other month.
Right. I was here and then I was there. Now it's a little bit more like, you know, 3 or 4 times a year, but staying longer. Mm-hmm. So this time, for instance, I arrived mid December and I'll be here until the end of January. So mm-hmm. That's a month and a half.
Lewis, if you could go back in time, this is a question I'd like to pose to everyone at the end of the podcast, and meet the younger Lewis Vigdon.
Yeah.
And give him advice based upon what you understand know now.
Oh.
How old would you be at that time you go back to, and what advice would you give yourself?
Interesting question. Very interesting question. Okay, so in retrospect, like I said, we probably over the course of my career of, let's say, a little over 40 years now, we've gotten into a lot of different businesses. I don't know if I would actually make too many changes of the way I tried to develop my business. I would probably protect myself a little bit better. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of things that, even with the large tobacco brands that I developed the market for, I think I could have protected myself. Mm-hmm. Even protected myself with this this low net weight, you know, arbitrage that I discovered, I might have been able to protect myself better. But you know, I believe in people's honesty, and that's probably why I just never did protect myself. But I would have done things differently, I think, in terms of trying to maintain the business or keep the business rather than, you know, just let it run its course, and then whatever happens, happens. You know, I probably would have done more to make proper divisions out of these businesses that I created. And one of the reasons I wasn't able to do that is because it was always me. It was right. always me.
You never and built a team.
I did build a team, but not a big enough of a team for there to be continuum. And it was okay because it kept me interested in looking around and exploring and, you know, trying to find and do different things.
And you give that up? You're not going to do that anymore? Or you think you're?
I'm giving it up. I'm gonna try to retire by the end of this year.
Okay. Yeah. And what does retirement mean for you?
So I've got places in New York, Miami, Hawaii, and here. Right. So I'll continue to spend, you know, 2 or 3 months each year in those places. I've got a list, a bucket list of things that I want to do, places that I want to see that I have not been to. So I'm going to start checking off my bucket list, and I'm not going to retire and just walk off into the sunset. I am going to be a very active retiree. Yeah, that's believe me, Lance.
That's what I'm talking about.
That's the most important thing that you can do. You just have to keep active.
Because if you don't, it's the end.
It's the end.
That's why I wanted to know what retirement meant to you.
Yeah, I think I told you earlier. I'm turning 70 this year. I want to retire by the time I'm 70. So hopefully I'll be able to do it by the time I'm 70, which is June. but you know, I'm a very healthy 70, right? I go to the gym at least 3 or 4 times a week. I eat well. I walk a lot. So I'll be healthy. My father he played tennis until 84.
There you go. Okay, so you know, at least you got that going.
Yeah. So I know I have the genes to actually allow me to spend at least the next 15, 20 years in relatively good health to do these things. That's right. And that's what I'm looking forward to.
There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, I appreciate it. Yeah.
Thanks, buddy.
Same here. I want to thank all of you for watching or listening to this podcast. And never forget, it's all on loan, so continue to reach for the stars.
Because you're too blessed to be stressed.